Hey guys, I'm Raf.
And I'm James.
On today's episode,
The Psychiatrist's Guide to
CBD.
Boom, 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 boom. You just really? Did that, yeah.
Nice. This institution. Did I just pee?
I mean, did you just pee?
So, you know what CBD is?
It stands for marijuana.
False.
Whoa, you're telling me, because CBD, as far as I know, CBD is marijuana. So when I'm in CVS and I see some gummies and they say CBD on them, as far as I know, I'm getting high.
Well, to start the story of CBD, we have to talk about cannabis or marijuana first.
Let me tell you about that, Raf. Let me school you a little bit. So did you know that cannabis is the most popular illicit drug?
No, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah. It's relatively inexpensive. It's fairly ubiquitous. And the ramifications of use are not as dire as, say, heroin. It's up there with caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol in terms of percentage of people who use it. There's archaeological evidence of cannabis that dates back to the Stone Ages in Central Asia.
Wow. When is the Stone Age?
The Stone Age is when people had only stone. That was it. People were actually made out of stone. They ate stone. Their pets were stone. I don't know.
It lasted 3.4 million years.
Wow.
Ended between 8700 and 2000 BC.
3.4 million years of cannabis use back in the day.
I don't think there were even humans around at that time.
Well, whatever they were getting high. All right. Burned cannabis has been found in burial mounds and tombs from over 5,000 years ago, which is pretty interesting. It has quite a distinct aroma. I don't know if maybe that played into the funeral rites of that civilization.
Maybe.
The first written record of cannabis use comes from 2737 BC. Chinese Emperor Shen Nung's Compendium of Medicinal Herbs had it in there. I'm sure they were using it for all types of wonderful remedies. And then in around 2000 BC, cannabis traveled to the Middle East and then to Europe and Northern Africa.
Oh, okay.
Didn't make its progression across the globe until about 2000 BC. And then finally, Spain, your ancestors, were getting high, and they brought it to the Americas in the 1500s.
Okay.
And I think what we need to talk about a little bit, and I think that you're going to go into this, Raf, is how the history of this substance in this country is not a cut and dry thing. It's not an easy thing to talk about. And if we're going to talk about it, you really do have to address some of the racism that's been tied up with cannabis in the United States. Isn't that right?
Right. So cannabis came to the United States in the early 1900s. It was brought mostly by Mexican immigrants who were fleeing the Mexican Revolution. It also was coming in through New Orleans by sailors from the Caribbean and South America, which is, by the way, how it got associated with black jazz music in New Orleans at the time.
And it's still sometimes referred to as jazz cigarettes, which I find very humorous.
Here's a quote attributed to Henry Aislinger, who was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. There are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing result from the marijuana use. The marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others. So, in fact, the reason that cannabis is called marijuana is most popularly in this country is because it was used as a scapegoat in the early 1900s for a lot of the behavior that was being attributed to Mexican immigrants coming during this time. At that time, as you know, at basically every other part of the history of the United States, the societal ills of our country have been blamed on whoever is the most recent immigrant. They did it to the Irish immigrants, to the Italian immigrants. In this case, specifically, we're talking about the Mexican immigrants of the early 1900s.
Mm.
And marijuana was a term that they used to refer to cannabis. You know, there were newspaper articles at the time blaming everything on the Mexican immigrants. You know, that when you hear that quote from Henry Aislinger, you see that that's what he's doing. He's tying the marijuana use to all of the crimes and the murdering sprees, quote unquote. And he's attributing all of that to the Mexican immigrants.
With probably little to no data.
Exactly.
To back that up.
Right. So 1937 was the first time that cannabis became illegal in the United States. It may have been illegal at the time under state law. But in 1937, it became under the purview of the federal government by virtue of the Marijuana Tax Act.
And this was importantly opposed by the American Medical Association at the time.
That's right. And one of the main arguments that the AMA gave is that nobody knew cannabis as marijuana at the time. So cannabis was being prescribed by physicians, and they had no idea when this Marijuana Tax Act came out that what the federal government was outlawing was cannabis.
Mm.
And so there wasn't as much of an opposition as there would have been. And if they had known that they were trying to outlaw cannabis, it would have never been allowed.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that even back then, it was still being used medicinally, not in a like colloquial shamanistic way, although right. I'm sure it was, but it was being used by medical professionals, MDs, associated with the American Medical Association for medical purposes. And I think it just goes to show how skewed our view of it has become, given the efforts of people like Aislinger. You know, it really is, marijuana really is kind of a dirty word. And yet it has all these wonderful properties that we'll discuss.
Right. And you know what's interesting that I found out? I had heard before that cannabis came largely from the Mexican immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And I always assumed that that meant that cannabis was very widely used and legal in Mexico. But ironically, it's quite the opposite. They were much more stringent.
Mm.
It was more vilified in Mexico than it was in America. And actually, that's where they kind of stole the playbook of vilifying cannabis and blaming it for all sorts of crimes.
So again, there's no real evidence to this. This is more of an agenda than it is based in any type of fact.
Right.
And it's
many people believe it was really made illegal in order to start rounding up immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Which, by the way, is another long tradition in this country, is whenever there is something that can be associated with minorities or people of poverty, it has been made illegal. And the laws have been applied disproportionately towards those people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are examples of it currently.
Yeah. So, you know, when we wanted to use cannabis to accomplish that nefarious goal, we called it marijuana. And when we wanted to use cocaine to accomplish that nefarious goal, we suddenly start calling a specific type of cocaine that's used by a certain type of population crack cocaine.
Yeah. Suddenly there was a crack epidemic.
Yeah.
And the penalties, I'm sure you're going to say. The penalties for crack use were much, much more severe than for powder cocaine, which was primarily used by wealthier and whiter Americans.
And again, not evidence-based. More marketing than anything else.
Right. So the popularity or the acceptance of cannabis in this country has ebbed and flowed over the years. Most prominently in the 1960s, during the counterculture, cannabis was a big part of that movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, like most other drugs during the war on drugs, it again fell out of favor and the use decreased in around the 1980s. And since the 1990s, the use has been increasing and more widely accepted. At this point, you know, I think most people accept cannabis use.
Yeah. I mean, this is getting a little personal, but just to relate my experience, I'm 32 years old. I was in high school from 2001 to 2005. You know, around that time, it was ubiquitous, completely ubiquitous. You would be hard-pressed to find someone who hadn't at least tried it or at least been around people who used it regularly.
So in the words of Eminem, marijuana is everywhere. Where was you brought up? is what you're trying to say.
Exactly. But okay. I think it was that way everywhere. Everyone that I've spoken to. I mean, it was certainly that way for you.
Well, I mean, we both grew up in northern New Jersey. So yeah. You can intuit my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So after covering the last, was it 30 million years?
Yeah, I think we did. We did a good job.
Yes. Let's move on until kind of like some of the medical properties of cannabis.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about the pharmacology.
All right. So I think the first thing to know about cannabis is that it's not one plant. It comes in several subspecies, including one without psychoactive substances at all. And that one's referred to hemp.
Right.
And obviously, we use hemp in industry to make rope, clothes, things like that, bags, things like that. It's a strong material. It's been used even far before, you know, the United States government decided to recast cannabis in this racist light.
Yeah, so hemp actually has a legal definition based on the amount of THC, THC being the psychoactive substance in cannabis, or at least the psychoactive substance in greatest concentration that's found in cannabis.
And that is the thing that has the psychoactive effect. So the other components of marijuana, including CBD, which is the topic of this episode, have effects on the human brain and the human body. But the substance that gets you quote-unquote high is the THC, the the tetrahydrocannabinol.
Right. And so hemp is categorized by various governments based on their THC level somewhere around, you know, less than 0.3%.
Okay.
Or 0.2%. Whereas what we would call weed or marijuana usually has somewhere between 1 to 5% of THC. And CBD, which is really short for cannabidiol.
Yeah.
Between THC and CBD, those are the two most abundant cannabinoids, so the two most abundant compounds in cannabis. The presence of CBD in cannabis, somewhere around like 40%.
Gotcha.
Right. And then there's probably, you know, there's dozens of other cannabinoids, but those are the two prominent players.
And, you know, getting back to THC for a second, that is what, when you do a urine test and it picks up cannabis, that is what it's looking for. THC is lipophilic, and that just means that it's absorbed into the fat in your body. And that's the reason why it stays in your body for so long. If substances are lipophilic, they get in and they leach out over the course of about a month, depending on your physiology.
Right. And do you remember, you know, people would get drug tested back in high school and it would somehow pass all the time?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Because I always heard that, you know, it stays in about a month. Actually, in light users, it's only detectable in the urine for about, you know, 2 to 3 days. It's when you become more of a chronic user that, you know, lasts in the system for about a month or so.
I heard so many like urban legends about how, you know, if you run for hours before, you know, they won't pick it up. Or if you just drink a lot of water. Yeah. I don't really think any of those are true, but there were certainly a lot of stories floating around. Yeah. Of that THC that your body ingests, 1% of it passes the blood-brain barrier, and that's metabolized in the liver. And I'm sorry, 1% of it passes the blood-brain barrier, and that's the THC that's going to give you that high, and the rest is just metabolized by the liver and excreted in the feces and the urine.
Right.
All right. So 11 norcarboxy THC is most often tested in the urine to be specific about which type of THC they're looking for.
But it doesn't have to be tested in urine. You know, it can be found in other, you know, parts of the body. You know, famously the hair, will last longer. And actually the place where I believe it lasts the longest, do you know where that is?
The butt.
Yes, that's right.
Wait.
No, it's not. No, I believe it's in the vitreous humor.
Really?
So the fluid in the eyeball.
Huh. That's cool. So we just got to take people's eyes out. Yeah. Test their humors.
So what are some of the effects of smoking cannabis or consuming cannabis, but in another form?
So obviously it can make you intoxicated, but in terms of how it affects the organ systems in your body, there are cardiovascular effects as well. And those can be seen as little as a minute after use, but the peak is about at half an hour after use. These effects last for 3 or 4 hours, and these effects are kind of delayed for edible cannabis.
Yeah. So have you heard those horror stories where people will eat a weed or a pot brownie and not feel anything, and then eat like 5 more, and then they end up in the hospital? So that's why it takes a little longer to get into the system, like any other substance, really, if you eat it compared to if you kind of get it more directly into the bloodstream.
Exactly.
Like smoking, for example.
So tell me a little bit about what cannabis does to you, how the properties it has on your body.
And these effects are going to kind of foreshadow some of the medicinal uses of cannabis or CBD at this time. So it's a weak anticonvulsant, meaning it reduces the chance of having a seizure.
Mm-hmm.
It has an opioid-like analgesic effect.
And that just means that it helps dull pain.
Mm-hmm. It has anti-diarrheal properties.
That means that it helps you not have diarrhea.
It has limbic system activation, obviously, because
it helps your reward system. And also it helps you not have diarrhea.
Did we forget that one?
No.
Well, it makes sense because if it's activating the limbic system, it's probably doing something with D2 or at least with dopamine, which is also anti-diarrheal medications. Also, some of them
exactly
work on dopamine.
Loperamide.
Oh yeah. So it enhances the production of catecholamines. The most famous catecholamines are dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much all of the same neurotransmitters that we're targeting when we're giving people medications like antidepressants, right?
So, Raph, is there anything that my body makes that is in any way similar to cannabis?
There is indeed. Now we know that there's endogenous cannabinoids such as anandamide, which means that there's really a cannabinoid system built within our body, right? We produce these kind of compounds and we have receptors for these kind of compounds. And they've identified a bunch of subtypes of receptors. For example, the CB1 and CB2 receptors. And
Creighton barrel 1, Creighton barrel 2. Sorry.
Yeah, correct.
I'm sorry.
And now we know that these cannabinoid receptors, especially primarily CB1 and CB2, are what THC works on to give us the effects of THC.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wanted to add is, you know, if anything puts in stark contrast how ridiculous it is to label and racialize an illicit substance, it is the fact that our bodies not only make something extraordinarily similar to it, but we have a system of receptors that operate on these substances.
Yeah, exactly.
How can you possibly racialize or demonize or moralize something like that?
Right.
That's just ridiculous to me.
Cannabinoids are also found in chocolate.
I think it's interesting that they can contribute to the runner's high. We've talked about endorphins before and the role that they play.
Right.
And
because endorphins, we said before, is endogenous morphine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that kind of is a preview of, you know, one of the believed effects of cannabinoids in the body.
And, you know, I've never done any illicit substances in my entire life, but I have had a runner's high. And I would guess, again, never done any illicit substance in my entire life, never broken any laws. I would guess that my experience of a runner's high, now that I'm thinking about it, would be shockingly similar to how one might feel when they were high on cannabinoids. But again, I've never done marijuana in my entire life, never even seen it.
So you're just guessing.
I'm just guessing.
We know a little bit about the location of a lot of these cannabinoid receptors, mostly done in animal models. The highest density of cannabinoid receptors in the brain is in the basal ganglia, as well as the cerebellum.
These are just structures that are kind of more down central in the brain, not higher up like the cortex.
Right. And which correlates to some of the motor effects that you can have from consuming cannabis.
Mm.
There are fewer receptors, but still a pretty high number of receptors in the hippocampus, the dentate gyrus, and in certain layers of the cortex.
I just love that term, dentate gyrus.
Yeah.
I just, and when you see it, in the anatomy of the brain, you're like, yeah, that's a dentate gyrus right there. It's oddly applicable.
So, for example, being in the hippocampus makes sense when you consider what cannabis does to your short-term memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lower density of receptors in some of the brainstem areas, which control the cardiovascular and respiratory functions. And that is consistent with cannabinoids' lack of lethality, right? Mm. Because ultimately the brainstem structures are responsible for keeping you breathing and keeping your heart beating and really a lot of the life-sustaining parts of a person.
Nowadays, we, you know, in psychiatry, in many ways it's unfortunate, but in order to treat something and in order to be paid for treating something, and people do struggle with using too much cannabis, we have to label it And because of that, there are several disorders that we talk about in psychiatry that are related to cannabis. So obviously, the first and foremost of those is cannabis use disorder. And along with that would go in the DSM-4, cannabis dependence.
Right.
But this is just the idea that someone is relying on cannabis in an unhealthy way.
Mm-hmm.
They've had thoughts that they want to cut down and they have been unable to. It's affecting their lives in various domains.
Right.
And to a certain extent, just generally speaking, it's negatively impacting their functioning.
Right, exactly. That's really the hallmark of any use disorder, that it's interfering with their life in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Another, you know, area of much debate in psychiatry is cannabis-induced psychosis.
Yeah, we talk frequently about how, you know, it's almost common knowledge among psychiatrists that if you are someone who is already predisposed to a psychotic disorder, you know, marijuana is just kind of lowering the threshold for that kind of thing.
Right. And there's a lot of debate, you know, there at least there has been in the past, whether the cannabis use itself can lead to schizophrenia,
mm-hmm.
or whether it's just like you're saying, somebody that, you know, was destined to develop a psychotic disorder, you know, was unmasked by the cannabis.
Yeah. I think there are studies that show that, yes, that is indeed the case. They're not the most robust, but I think the evidence is pretty strongly indicating, you know, in that direction. But again, there are various issues that I could point out with studies like that. Again, we're dealing with a substance that, you know, unfortunately, due to the racist history of it, is used by no small percentage of the African American population. The African American population also, not necessarily for the most scientific reasons, is more frequently diagnosed with schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorders.
And I think that we should do a whole episode on that.
Yeah.
Because there's been some good research done in this institution about, you know, the racism behind the diagnosis of certain mental conditions, especially you know, schizophrenia and severe bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
Another diagnosis in the DSM-5 is cannabis-induced anxiety.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, again, no firsthand experience, but I have had really good friends who I know very well tell me that yes, indeed, mm-hmm. cannabis does worsen paranoia, and you know that in many popularized in media, that's like the hallmark of cannabis use is you're suddenly paranoid. You think that people are after you.
Yeah. I've found that, you know, most of the patients that I've seen and the people that I've known that smoked heavily at some point and then stopped. A lot of them tell me it's because of this, because it started making them really anxious or really paranoid when smoking.
So I've been in the PTSD clinic at one of our local VAs for about a year now. I've got plenty of patients who the VA does not give medical marijuana cards, but medical marijuana cards are readily available in the state of New Jersey. So I've got plenty of vets who will discuss with me the possibility of using, you know, cannabis. They'll go, they'll get the card. And especially in the case of someone who's suffering with something like PTSD, where there is already a baseline level of paranoia that comes along with the diagnosis, a lot of times the level of paranoia can really be debilitating for them. If you're already at baseline, patrolling around your home, putting up cameras, this is not going to help. It may help with pain. It may help with appetite and things like that. But I often caution patients who are already anxious that this might not be the thing for you.
And another diagnosis that's debated is so-called amotivational syndrome, which is a syndrome of apathy, social withdrawal, loss of interest, although this is, you know, kind of hotly debated in the medical field.
Mm-hmm. And I think there are other disorders as well, not necessarily in the realm of psychiatry, but, you know, very real things that can happen after you smoke, for example, hyperemesis.
Mm-hmm.
It happens both to people who use initially, but you'll also see it in people who, I've seen a case in this emergency room with someone who was an extremely heavy user and never vomited for years, crossed some sort of threshold.
Interesting.
And just intractable vomiting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, all of that talk about cannabis was kind of backstory to lead up to talking specifically about CBD. So what is CBD? What does it stand for?
It stands for cannabidiol, which is one of the many cannabinoids that we mentioned earlier. in cannabis. It's present in high concentrations, over 40%.
Yeah, so think about that. The THC presence in cannabis is like, you know, 1 to 5% usually. There's like over 100 cannabinoids.
So it's by and large, even though the THC is the thing that, you know, I think we associate with how marijuana makes you feel, there's certainly more of this in marijuana.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So does CBD get you high?
No. CBD is non-psychoactive, and it doesn't significantly bind to CB1 or CB2, which, again, as we mentioned before, those are the receptors that the THC binds to.
Right.
To induce those kind of effects that are stereotypical of marijuana use.
And my understanding is the proposed mechanism for how CBD works is by decreasing the reuptake of anandamide. And anandamide is like a natural endogenous cannabinoid that does bind the CB1 and 2 receptors. But it's such like a convoluted route that it doesn't bind the CB1 and 2 directly, and not enough through the anandamide that it would give you the psychoactive effects.
Gotcha. I think it's interesting that the vast majority of CBD on the market actually comes from hemp.
Yeah.
Which we discussed before.
That's right.
A kind of more industrially important variant.
Right. So let's talk about what hemp is exactly. So you mentioned before there are different species of cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know them? You're an expert on this? Hydro doesn't count. nor does Purple Haze. Or the skunk.
You know, it's funny. I'm not an expert, but these are definitely, you know, these are definitely words that I've heard and you hear thrown around. So there's sativa. I think that's commonly, you know, referred to. Indica. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard of ruderalis.
Yeah, I never heard of that one before. I did come across it. I think it's from Russia. It's another one that is psychoactive.
It sounds like a metal band from the 90s. But hemp is actually a type of sativa. Sativa L or Sativa Linnaeus.
Named after that guy.
Yeah. And this is hemp that contains a really low amount of THC, 0.3% or less of THC on a dry weight basis. And that just means it's dry and you're weighing it. And that is a number that's decided upon by the federal government, but it also kind of correlates with the amount of THC that's naturally found in hemp in nature.
Exactly. And the reason that the CBD that we get comes from hemp is because although even the legality even of hemp is kind of in question, there are laws that provide for hemp to be legal in order for it to be used in various industries.
Is there a difference between CBD oil, products that are marketed as CBD oil, and products that are marketed as hemp oil?
Yes. This is kind of like a marketing scam. These aren't necessarily real, like, scientific definitions. But CBD oil generally refers to oil that's extracted from the hemp plant and contains CBD. So if you're trying to get CBD, that's what you should be getting. But there are a lot of, I don't want to call them, you know, scammers, because I don't know what their motive is, but at least some of them may be scammers, that are using hemp oil, which is just hemp seed oil. So it's from the seed of the hemp and doesn't contain any cannabinoids, although it is rich in fatty acids, so it may have its own beneficial properties. But you shouldn't be confused if you're purchasing, you know, if you're trying to get CBD oil. Usually if it's called CBD oil, it is CBD. If it's called hemp oil, it comes from the seed instead of the whole plant, and it doesn't have any cannabinoids.
Got it.
Now, CBD is approved for 2 conditions by the FDA.
Whoa.
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
I didn't know it either until I researched it.
Can I guess?
Sure. Yeah. I think you can guess. At least one of the two you'll guess, because you probably heard of a lot of people being on it.
Are you all right? At first I was going to cheat a little bit and ask you if these indications were in the realm of psychiatry or just generally in the realm of medicine, but I will guess the two that I'll guess are anxiety and maybe weight gain.
No, that's wrong.
Both are wrong?
Correct.
Oh my God. That's so funny. Wait, let me get another guess. All right.
Think for a second. Uh-huh. Think of little kids. that have a crippling syndrome that won't respond to medications. No, they're medications that we often prescribe, but they're not really within our realm.
Seizure disorder?
Exactly. So
only took four guesses, Raph.
No, you got it. But in hindsight, you've heard that, right? That people are using CBD for seizure disorders, right?
Yes, or have you not? I have.
Okay. So there actually is a medication on the market called Epidiolex, which is a CBD solution that's approved by the FDA for two seizure disorders. Do you want to guess either one of them?
Absolutely not. Although I have... I know what they are, and I've treated both, actually.
Have you, really?
Yeah.
I've seen the one a few times.
Well, they're called Lennox-Gastaut syndrome and Dravet syndrome. I know a little bit more about Dravet syndrome.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. It's the other one that I saw.
The Dravet syndrome, I believe, is due to a malfunctioning sodium channel and leads to potentially... intractable seizures, and I'm going to check that right now because I feel like I'm very, very wrong.
I can't believe you remember that much detail. I have no idea, but I'm going to look mine up too.
Oh my God, I got it right.
Nice.
So in Dravet syndrome, it's caused by a nonsense mutation in the SCN1A gene, and that codes for a sodium channel. Yeah, and Dravet syndrome, I remember this very well. I had a few patients who suffered from this. Very sad. You know, it can be prolonged febrile or non-febrile seizures. It can be myoclonic. It can be partial. It can be almost ataxic. And that's just, you know, these are words that we use to just differentiate the type of seizure, just how it looks when the patient is actually having the movement disorder. It is associated with that gene. And I remember, you know, for a lot of patients, for a lot of the children with this disorder, you know, it was a fairly... debilitating disease. So it's nice that there is something out there.
Yeah. And similarly, Lennox-Gastaut syndrome is a very severe intractable seizure disorder that usually starts in childhood. And the reason I couldn't remember the cause is because it's idiopathic, meaning we don't know. Maybe somebody knows, but I don't know.
Because it's a drug, all drugs have side effects. So if they're using this to treat seizures, you know, what can patients also expect?
Right. And this is very informative, because if these are the side effects of this CBD oil, you know, in its medication form, then you can infer that as long as you're getting pure CBD oil, you may have similar side effects from the stuff that you're buying at this gas station or whatever.
Sure.
So what are the side effects?
So one is CNS depression. Okay. And by that, we just mean... You know, if we were going to say in layman's terms what that is, it would just be drowsiness. Obviously, it's a little more nuanced than that. But in terms of what you might experience overall, a decreased state of consciousness.
Yeah.
It can also lead to loss of appetite.
Interesting. Because people, you know, there's other preparations, from cannabis that we'll talk about in a minute that are used to stimulate appetite.
And I erroneously guessed that CBD might be used for that purpose. Shows you how well-informed I am.
At least not in the medical form. But my understanding is that this medication is pretty much just CBD oil.
Wow. And interestingly, it can cause suicidal ideation, which is also very surprising. You know, a lot of things that you would not expect to be associated.
Yes, although... You know, I did a little research into that because I was a little shocked by that. I think it's because almost all anticonvulsants carry that warning of suicidal ideation. Whether or not, I think the studies were done for that one. And I think because it falls in the class of an anticonvulsant, meaning an anti-seizure medication, it also carries that label of suicidal ideation.
Gotcha.
I don't believe that there's any studies actually with CBD causing suicidal ideation, but of course I could be wrong because
sure. And the last one is hepatotoxicity, which is just, it can damage your liver. A lot of medications, depending on how they're metabolized, can damage either your liver or your kidney. But it seems that Epidiolex isn't the only medication that we use for various things that's derived from cannabis.
Well, we're talking about loss of appetite, so I think we should do that one next.
Sure.
And this one I prescribed, well, through my attending in the hospital. I don't know if you've ever prescribed it.
No.
Dronabinol.
No, never prescribed it.
Or Nabilone is another, I guess, formulation. And this is synthetic THC. And the indication for this is chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. Also, appetite stimulation and wasting disease. And that second one is what I prescribed it for.
Gotcha. We often use an antidepressant in certain cases called mirtazapine that can have similar effects. And it's often used on consult services for patients who are suffering with cancer or at an end of life and they're not eating and they're not sleeping. And it has somewhat similar effects. But
my recollection is this guy, he was a young guy too. It wasn't, you know, clearly diagnosed, but it seemed to be some sort of eating disorder, which was secondary to a chronic gastrointestinal illness.
Mm.
And we had him on Remeron and he didn't respond. And I think we tried several different medications and it didn't respond, you know, as far as increasing the appetite. And he insisted that, you know, smoking weed was the only thing that gave him appetite at home. So, you know, we tried it with the approved medication. He was wasting. This kid was very thin. Well, young man.
It's very sad. It's funny, you know, I've been working with one of our addiction fellows. And before he came to train with us as an addiction fellow, he worked for over 15 years as a gerontologist and just a clinician. And he is very familiar with a lot of the studies associated with, you know, how you can possibly use psychiatric medications in the elderly to help with things like this. We were talking about mirtazapine Remeron, and apparently the studies show that even in select cases where you think it might do good, the most weight gain you can really expect with Remeron is about 2 pounds.
Oh, wow.
So really, it's quite ineffective when it comes to that type of stuff. Whereas I'm sure dronabinol and Nabilone, especially if they have the indication, are probably superior in that regard.
Probably.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I didn't know it was that little with Remeron, although it does seem to help people sleep pretty well.
That said, yeah, oh yeah. And that said, you know, one of the things that we identified when we were looking at the studies is that this isn't young people. This isn't healthy people.
Right.
Obviously, if you start it in a young person, the weight gain may be more.
Yeah.
If you're starting it in a person that already has a terminal illness, you know, you might not see much weight gain because the patient is already, unfortunately, kind of, you know, so far gone. So
right.
There's obviously limitations to the study, but it was
surprising. That's a good point because the weight gain isn't necessarily the end goal. If you think about it, it's more getting the nutrition in, you know, giving them the appetite so that they eat. Because if they don't eat, you know, gaining 2 pounds compared to losing 20 actually is pretty significant, you know.
Very true. Very true.
All right. But we're going on and on about Remeron and synthetic THC when this is supposed to be about CBD. So the next medication I'm going to talk about is a combination of THC and CBD. And those are nabiximols. This is an oral spray that's derived from THC and CBD. It's not approved in the U.S. It's approved in other countries for spasticity in multiple sclerosis and for cancer pain that's not controlled by opioids.
Is the you might not know this. Do you know if the research is good? Is there a reason why we don't have it approved here other than our puritanical thoughts about cannabis?
I'm not sure. Honestly, I can't answer that question. Although I tend to believe the European countries. I don't know if that's naive, but you know, I trust them when they give indications for medications because there are medications that we use off-label that are approved for those indications in Europe, you know. This may be coming to us. I don't know, you know.
Yeah. I'm just on a cursory glance on UpToDate, it does seem that there's certainly evidence behind it and it's I wouldn't be surprised. I'm with you, generally speaking. You know, we have a history in this country of being very slow when it comes to approving medications. And, you know, we've done some episodes in the past where that's certainly changing. And we've actually expressed a little bit of alarm about some of the things that the FDA has approved. But
absolutely.
Generally speaking, I think they are still somewhat slow. And I'm with you, you know. Change seems to, in a lot of ways, especially in our field, change seems to happen first in Europe and kind of come here gradually. And it does seem, just taking a quick look, that there is certainly evidence for it. So
again, inferring, you know, what the approved medications are used for can kind of suggest what CBD in and of itself may be helpful for. So in this case, it's approved for spasticity, meaning like muscle stiffness, you know, but mm-hmm. really severe muscle stiffness in multiple sclerosis, which is a very serious medical illness that can be debilitating to people and kind of has a long course. It doesn't go away, you know. So you can infer maybe that CBD can have some kind of relaxation effects on the muscles. However, sure. keep in mind that in this case, it's THC and CBD. So we don't know which one's doing which. And then the other indication is cancer pain. And that's interesting because that's what a lot of people are using CBD for, that they're buying, you know, off the shelves is for pain. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's kind of shift gears a little bit from medications that are approved either in this country or in other countries derived from cannabis and CBD. And let's talk about the evidence of CBD for specific conditions.
Not, I love it.
Right, not necessarily like the prescribed forms, but just CBD in general, the research that's been done with, you know, CBD for the things that people are using them for.
Okay. You know, Raph.
Yes.
You know, we're starting to think about jobs. I'm not sleeping so good. You know, we got a lot of big decisions coming up in our life. Where are we going to practice? What type of thing are we going to do? Are we going to do fellowship? I really could use some help getting some Z's at night.
I'm yawning as you say that.
So can CBD help me with that, Raph?
Maybe. So
why is that?
So the studies have shown mixed results. Apparently, CBD in low doses can be stimulating, whereas in high doses, it's found to be more sedating.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like the reverse of Remeron.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of medications that we prescribe that at different doses have kind of like a different side effect profile, you know?
Sure.
And if you don't pay attention to it, you know, most of the research that has been done, actually, I'll just mention it quickly, is in THC. And it's kind of important to mention because it explains why CBD may or may not work. Studies have shown that THC decreases sleep latency, meaning it helps you fall asleep faster, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, I'm sure you've had tons of patients that tell you that they smoke weed every night to sleep for one reason or another. The problem is that tolerance develops, meaning after you know, a couple of weeks or however long, it no longer does that. And now you're just kind of, you have to use it just to get your bad sleep in. Otherwise, your sleep would be even worse, you know? And it also causes THC, this is daytime sleepiness, poor memory, and other side effects that we talked about in the past. So,
it doesn't sound great.
Right. Now,
I'm having nightmares because, you know, I'm having nightmares that they put like a really crummy contract in front of me. And I have to work in the ER for 24-hour shifts, 7 days a week. So is it going to help me at all with that?
So there is some evidence that THC can be used in PTSD for nightmares. Now, this is THC, not cannabis.
Okay.
And I think we should do a whole kind of episode on this, on THC and PTSD. It's not sufficient evidence that it's like approved for that use, but there is some evidence. So that is pretty interesting.
And you know, the medications that we do use for nightmares in the setting of PTSD, namely Prazosin, that doesn't have that much great evidence behind it either. And what the studies do show is actually potentially some other agents like propranolol may even be more effective. But even then, the efficacy there is somewhat limited. Now, there's one other thing, Raph. There's one other thing. My fiance Shannon, she sleeps next to me, and she says I snore
like a pig.
Like a pig driving a freight train through a wall. And she says that I wake up in the middle of the night gasping for air. Also, I have these weird headaches like throughout the day. And also, I weigh 500 pounds.
And your blood pressure is high?
My blood pressure is really high. So what do you think is going on there?
So I'll pause for 3 seconds to let the listeners get to the diagnosis. You're suffering most likely from obstructive sleep apnea.
Oh my God.
And now there's some research for THC and CBD in obstructive sleep apnea. THC there's been studies in animals and also in humans where dronabinol, the THC that's approved by the FDA for appetite stimulation and that, you know, we talked about before, decreases the number of apneas or apneic episodes, meaning the number of times that you stop breathing in the middle of the night.
Okay.
But that research shows that the CB1 and CB2 receptors are involved in mediating that pathway. And so we talked about before, CBD doesn't really stimulate those receptors very strongly. So you wouldn't think necessarily that CBD would be able to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. However, something else I didn't know is that serotonin, the neurotransmitter we try to manipulate most often to treat depression and anxiety, works to keep the airways open at night. Did you know that? I had no idea.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I'm learning a lot, Raph.
And there's some evidence that CBD activates serotonin receptors. So it's possible that CBD could have the same kind of effect.
Sure. That is not surprising to me. Finally, something that I could have intuited.
And one more thing. I know I'm going off the deep end. This is all stuff that I learned and is really fascinating. There's some evidence for SSRIs, for antidepressants and obstructive sleep apnea for the same reason, because you talked about the serotonin helps keep the airways open. However, kind of emphatically, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends against the use of cannabis for obstructive sleep apnea. So there is some evidence there, but the American Academy of Sleep Medicine says, no, don't do it. We said a lot there, so let's kind of recap, you know, the last couple things we were talking about. We're talking about CBD for insomnia, so for basically for sleep and people who are having trouble sleeping. There's more research done with THC than there is for CBD. And pretty much it looks like THC isn't really the best thing to use for sleep, right? Mm-hmm. The evidence isn't good for that. There is much less evidence for CBD. Whether it can help or not, you know, I guess remains to be seen. But there's not much evidence for it in sleep. There is evidence for THC in PTSD nightmares, but I haven't seen any research for CBD itself. And then we went off on a tangent about obstructive sleep apnea, saying that THC may help in that and that CBD probably doesn't, but also could through a different mechanism. But the American Academy of Sleep Medicine says don't use cannabis, which would contain THC and CBD. So not great evidence really for using CBD for sleep, right?
Doesn't sound like a first line
kind
of deal. But what about CBD for anxiety?
Yeah, this is a big one, I think, that people are using it for, right?
Yeah. So. And it's one of the ones I guessed. Surprised it didn't have the indication, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing to point out, and I especially tell my PTSD patients this, because often they come in and they want cannabis, obviously. You know, I tell them, listen, part of the PTSD, and really part of a lot of anxiety disorders, is a sense of paranoia, and THC and cannabis use can worsen anxiety and paranoia. So,
absolutely,
yes, obviously, you know, cannabis can be sedating, THC can be sedating, but also it can certainly worsen thoughts that you are being targeted, that someone is out to get you, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and it's no joke. A lot of patients and other people that I've known that have been, you know, heavy cannabis users that eventually stopped using cannabis is because they started getting paranoid and anxious every time they smoked. So that is a common thing that I've heard. So it's no joke. This is not like a rare thing. And we'll talk in a minute. I think we'll talk about specifically about the paranoia in the realm of psychosis as opposed to the realm of anxiety kind of paranoia.
Sure.
So unlike on insomnia, CBD does have some evidence for reduction of anxiety. Interestingly, we kind of alluded to this in the past, CBD in low doses activates the serotonin receptors, and we know that CBD also modulates the norepinephrine and GABA receptors. So, you know, serotonin and norepinephrine are the neurotransmitters that we target when we're treating anxiety disorders, as well as GABA, you know, the main mechanism of action of benzodiazepines that people tend to love so much until something bad happens. There is logical reason to think that CBD is promising for anxiety, and there's also evidence in some, you know, small studies that CBD helps with anxiety.
I think it's fascinating that CBD modulates serotonin receptors and norepinephrine receptors, as well as GABA, you know, because we have a class of medications, the SNRIs, serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, venlafaxine, and duloxetine that do just that. And
Effexor can be very good for generalized anxiety disorder, actually.
Exactly, exactly. And a lot of times
it can be... venlafaxine, sorry.
Venlafaxine, yeah. And a lot of times venlafaxine can be so sedating that I'll actually instruct patients to take it at night. Mm-hmm. It is a 24-hour medication, but oftentimes, especially when you begin it, there's certainly a sense of sedation that usually goes away with a few days. But in the case of venlafaxine, it can definitely continue on for the duration of the use of the medication, which can be beneficial.
I saw something in the literature about CBD targeting patterns of blood flow and a belief that maybe that's how it can help treat anxiety.
Sure. I mean, if it's affecting norepinephrine, it's certainly having an effect on the vasculature.
Right, exactly. So going back to the PTSD thing, but this time in the context of anxiety, CBD has been shown to decrease the formation of fear memories and increase extinction. So James, you're the PTSD guy here. What do those things mean? So so the first one is it decreases the formation of fear memories.
I think that obviously speaks for itself. If you're lucky enough to be exposed to this in the peritraumatic phase, it might help decrease the ramifications of the trauma later on because you are not reinforcing those memories. And when we talk about extinction, we simply mean the memory fading in so many terms. And so it's good that it does both of those things. I think it's great that it has, that there is some evidence showing that it can be used right after the trauma and also later on. There is some evidence to show that getting appropriate medical attention, both psychiatric and otherwise, immediately after a traumatic event can drastically decrease the effects of that trauma on your life later on. And it's interesting to see that CBD can potentially play a similar role.
Yeah, it's saying it can prevent you from really getting PTSD in the first place, and it can also help you get rid of PTSD is the suggestion, really, if you read between the lines. However, we have to emphasize, this is very preliminary research. This is nowhere near the kind of research that would be needed to start using CBD for anxiety. Okay, so, I mean, if you're using CBD for anxiety, I mean, there is more evidence for anxiety, I think, than for insomnia, but still insufficient evidence.
Yeah, definitely agree there.
So another reason that people commonly use CBD is for pain.
So definitely heard of that one.
Pain conditions can be, you know, crippling, literally. And there are, you know, plenty of people that, you know, it's really a subjective thing, and it's hard to kind of diagnose and treat in many cases. There is a formulation used in other countries, Sativex, which is a combination of THC and CBD that is approved for spasticity and multiple sclerosis and also for cancer pain that doesn't respond to opioids. So, but again, this is THC and CBD. It's not CBD by itself.
You know, it's interesting to me that you certainly hear about a lot of people using CBD for joint pain and arthritic pain, but it actually turns out that CBD may actually be better for a different type of pain. So what are we talking about there?
So despite the fact that, you know, it seems like a lot of people are using it for joint pain, it probably has the weakest evidence of all of the types of pain where there's a lot of research. There is some animal studies that suggest that CBD could be effective in joint pain, but the evidence is a lot better for neuropathic pain, actually. The evidence is better for neuropathic pain than for cancer pain, actually.
And just for our audience, what is an example of neuropathic pain? How is that different from somatic pain?
This is kind of tricky because ultimately all pain involves nerves.
Sure.
But this refers to a kind of pain mediated by irritation of the nerves. The most classic one, for example, would be diabetic neuropathy. So you get numbness and tingling in the feet, and you know, you get loss of sensation and also tons of pain. But there can be many other types of neuropathy. And it makes sense, though, that CBD may be effective given the things that we've said before. It's approved as a seizure medication. A lot of the medications that we use, neuropathic pain, are seizure medications, or at least they started that way. For example, gabapentin. There are studies for CBD by itself, but there's fewer studies and the results are even worse than for, you know, the things that I've talked about before. It seems like a lot of the studies with Sativex and with cannabis suggest that binding of the CB1 receptor is really responsible for the analgesic effect, so the pain reduction effect. And mm-hmm. we said before, CBD doesn't significantly bind the CB1 receptor. So okay. there's a problem there. But nonetheless, you know, the evidence for cannabis-derived medications in pain in general is pretty robust, and it's actually approved in other countries at this point for specific types of pain.
Gotcha.
So I think we went from worst to best. Right. I think, the evidence doesn't look great, I think, for insomnia, although maybe, you know, we'll see. Mm-hmm. It looks better for anxiety, but still very preliminary. And mm-hmm. it looks even better for pain. But, sure. you know, these are specific types of pain. And still, this is kind of preliminary evidence, with the exception probably of the approval of, you know, this medication in Europe for cancer pain and stress tissue. Sure. All right. So, James, we're about to reach a first for our podcast.
Oh my God. What's about to happen? We got a million subscribers.
We are going
to end. You don't need to tell me.
We are going to end on a cliffhanger. We're going to split this episode into two parts.
Oh my God. We're missing half the story here.
Yeah. So to this point, we've talked about the reasons that people very commonly use CBD. But when we get into the next episode, we're going to talk about some of the other kind of out there evidence that there is for CBD for other conditions that most people don't know about.
I love it. I can't wait. So we like to end every episode saying that if you're struggling with any of the things that we've discussed today or anything that we've discussed in previous episodes, anxiety, depression, insomnia, you know, we want you to know that there's help. Don't be afraid to reach out and get it. You know, get hooked up with a psychiatrist, get hooked up with a mental health professional in whatever way you have available to you. You can always call 1-800-273-HELP if you are experiencing something even more acutely. And obviously, if you're having thoughts of hurting yourself or others, go to your nearest emergency room.
Or call 911.
Catch
us on the next episode for part two of the Psychiatrist's Guide to CBD. Until then,
adios.
Peace.